This is a Triple J podcast.
The way that we as gay men sometimes feel we should be participating in the community can lead to drug taking and sex and hooking up.
Hello, Dee Salmon here with you for the Hookup Podcast, where we talk all things love, sex, dating and relationships. And you know how this works. Every Thursday, I bring you a chat. It could be potentially a DM that you sent us and you're like, hey, Dee Pitt, can you help me out with this? And we'll grab an expert and we'll unpack it. Or I introduce you to someone that I think that you would love to hear from. And that's what we're going to do in this ep today. I recently read a book called Fruit Fly by an author called Josh Silver. And I absolutely loved it. And selfishly, I wanted to interview Josh. But also I think that Josh writes about a really important conversation and something that I think we haven't really spoken about on The Hookup when it comes to gay and queer culture. So let me just quickly, if you don't know the plotline of Fruit Fly, the book is told from the perspective of two characters, Mallory and Leo. And so Mallory is an author and she basically hasn't written a good book in a while, and she's got writer's block and she now wants to try and write a bestseller. So she looks up online like, how do I write a great book? And a Reddit post told her you need to go gay, go sad, or go dark. She then uses her husband's photos to get on Grindr and create a fake profile where she tries to get to know a few gay guys. She gets invited to this thing called a tea party. She doesn't realize it's a chem sex party. And at that party, she meets a young gay addict called Leo. And she basically just stalks him, befriends him, gets to know him to almost like steal or use his story for her novel. So it's a really fascinating book. It's told through their two perspectives. And a massive theme of Fruit Fly is who has the right to tell which stories, right? Especially when it comes to queer perspectives or, you know, people who have traumatic backgrounds or drug addictions, that kind of thing. Where do we draw the line between, you know, cultural appropriation and appreciation? It's a really fascinating conversation, a really important one. So in this episode you're about to hear, I spoke to Josh about his experiences as someone who previously dealt with drug addiction, but also, yeah, like where, as a gay man, like where does he sit on this conversation now, especially when it's quote unquote cool to write stories from queer perspectives. We'll also talk about chemsex parties and how there's a lot of shame and pain and anxiety around that space for some people, and it's not really a conversation that we're having and why it's important, and also how Josh is feeling with how much his book has blown up in the past couple of months. Anne Hathaway, I don't know if you saw that viral clip, she was obsessed with the book. A24 has also recently won the rights for it to be a TV series. So much to unpack, and I managed to catch Josh in the middle of his book tour at the moment, and he zoomed in from New York City in some random park. I love this chat. Bit of a heads up though, we do talk about drug addiction, we talk about mental health, we talk about chemsex. So if any of this conversation brings up something for you, we'll have some resources in the show notes and some numbers that you can call. Please as well though, look after yourself. Feel free to pause this pod and come back to it whenever you feel up for it. But yeah, let's get into it. Josh, thank you so much for coming on The Hookup.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now, I need to quickly tell you the story about how I ended up reading Fruit Fly. So I just released a book recently, and at my book launch, my best friend Brendan actually saw your book and he bought that and went home and absolutely smashed it. He read it in like 2 days. And then he basically said to me, Dee, you will love this book. It is one of the best books I've ever read. This is his copy. He told me to read it. And so I read it. I loved it so much. And I'm really, really excited to chat to you today. So yeah, just wanted to let you know that in Australia...
Did your friend read your book at all?
Oh yeah, I mean, he's in it. So he was...
Okay.
Yeah, don't worry.
Okay, fine.
He was part of the editing process. He read his section.
Oh, great.
He was across it. But
got you.
No, he was so excited about your book as a gay man and, you know, the perspectives that you share. I think he even DM'd you, which is classic Brendan.
Oh no, did he?
Yeah, you replied.
Oh, I did?
Yeah, good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it is such a brilliant and meta story, which we're going to unpack. And it has a similar energy to Yellowface. For anyone who's read mm-hmm. that book, they would kind of understand.
That was a huge inspiration for Fruit Fly.
Yeah, I thought it might have been. Josh, how did you come up with the idea?
Well, I was an actor like a long time ago, and I graduated from drama school, and I remember graduating and being told, you know, you can't be gay. I got told it's not going to help you and you're not in the right casting bracket for that, and it's you're not going to get jobs, so just keep it quiet, keep it to yourself. And then there was a lot of people who were in my sort of graduating cohort of across the drama schools in London who felt, I don't know, it was just like, you don't talk about it, you know, you play straight. And I was going into these auditions playing straight and struggling with my identity, with the career, just really not feeling great about it all, not having a great relationship with myself. And then, you know, cut to 8-9 years later, and there's this big shift culturally, and all of a sudden diversity becomes popular and cool, and people start accepting other people. And my agent would be like, oh no, you can be gay now, you're fine, go and
it's
be gay
fine.
So you're allowed now. So I found it offensive and confusing, and I read Yellowface and I thought what RF Kuang did with that was really great. And then I saw a film called American Fiction, which was a brilliant takedown of the publishing industry, and I just thought, I want to do that. And I don't know, I come up with a lot of my plots on runs. I run a lot, well, as much as I can, and it just sort of happened, and I started it, and I shared it with an agent who loved it and was like, let's go for it. So we did it.
I just love that it's so like Inception, in the fact that it's like you writing about a publishing industry that tells you to go gay mm-hmm. and to go dark. And then, you know, it's almost like an author inside an author. And then you're the author. Yeah. And then the book has done so well, which proves your point. Do you know what I mean?
It is a bit strange. But there was a moment in time where I finished the first draft of... No, sorry. I finished... It was going to the proofreaders. And I finished it. I sent it to my agent, my editor, sorry. And I got on a plane. I went on a holiday and I landed off the flight, and I was like, oh no. I emailed him and said, I'm gonna change the ending, I'm so sorry, I don't like the ending. And he said, you've got a week. And I was like, just leave it with me. And then I deleted the ending, and I sat down and I started writing Mallory, emailing her editor saying she wants to change the ending of her book, and she changed her ending, which was my original ending, into her ending, and I was writing my new ending. So it all became very strange and meta.
Josh, how much of your own experiences did you draw from when writing the character Leo?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of me in Leo, for sure. I think I relate a lot to his performance of his pain. I'm sober now. I've been 9 years sober. So I was struggled with drugs and alcohol for what felt like a long time. And I used them to sort of muddle through the pain. And then I sort of got caught up in the slippery slope of drug use, which led to chemsex. And I think what I relate most to him is how he reduces trauma and his pain as a way of manipulating other people and getting what he needed, not actually dealing with it. And I feel like I was in that space for quite a long time. And I didn't sleep in bins. Leo likes to sleep in bins. I tried not to, that's for sure. But I felt lost and felt like I'd sort of ruined my potential. And I think he has an element of that too. And it was important for me, you know, there's a lot of queer narratives being told at the moment. And I think, you know, if we're going to tell certain fantasy versions of the queer narrative, we should make sure the other ones are in there too. And chemsex is a real problem in the gay community. I know many people can have boundaries with that kind of stuff, and I certainly don't judge. You know, people should be able to be free to do what they want, but I'm also very aware that it's very dangerous for lots of people. And, you know, with what happened to me, it's a slippery slope. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really discriminate. Lots of different gay men from all factions of society can struggle with it. And it's, you know, people are full of shame around it and don't want to talk about it. because it feels uncomfortable and icky and messy. And I just think there's a real problem. And I think it's important to bring it to the forefront. And there's a comment in the book sort of around how straight people view gay people and what they find palatable and what they want to take in as a gay narrative. But then when the reality of it comes to their doorstep, maybe it's too much, or they still want to watch, but they don't want to be involved. You know, they like getting shocked or witnessing. You know, we like to be voyeurs to pain, but to be in the middle of it is something very different. And I think I just wanted to explore that with the book.
Yeah, that really came across. And I want to unpack that a bit more in a sec around, you know, what queer narratives have kind of been told and why this one's important. But for people who don't understand, because there might be people listening right now who don't understand what chemsex is, there's a really funny scene in the book where Mallory goes on Grindr. She's like, obviously realized, oh, I've got to go gay, I've got to go dark. And she wants to, you know, learn a bit more about the gay community and pretends to be a gay man. And then she gets invited to like a tea party. And she obviously has no idea what this is. So she like packs a picnic basket, which is really funny. But then she rocks up to this guy's house and it kind of becomes dark when she realizes, oh no, this is, they're taking drugs.
Yeah.
And having sex. For someone listening, what does it actually entail?
Well, there's hooking up and taking drugs, and then there's sort of like planned parties or chills, as people will call them, which is a specific concoction of drugs. And also those drugs can like enhance performance or feeling, and can make you feel like you're connecting, and they can keep you up for a very long time and keep you going for a very long time. So G, meth, two of the sort of bigger, more widely used ones in that scene. And not everyone who goes uses the drugs, and it's important to say that, but those are the drugs that would sort of, from my experience, circulate those parties, and people can sort of continue on for days. Yeah.
I liked that when you spoke about Leo, and this shouldn't give too much away for people who haven't read the book yet, but also listen, if you're listening to an interview about the book, you're going to get stuff spoiled. But I liked that you spoke about how Leo didn't actually have like that traumatic of a background to end up in that space.
Right.
And I thought that was really important, because I think sometimes we think like, oh, you know, what horrific, and Mallory kind of wants that, and is, that's why he's feeding her the kind of traumatic background about his past with his mum and that kind of thing. And I think sometimes we think, oh, drug addiction would never happen to me, because it only happens to people who have these like horrific backgrounds, right? Why was that an important part to share in the story? And was that kind of similar to you? Like, how did you end up down that path as well?
I think my story, it's always going to be complicated for a gay guy who's possibly coming out in a world that doesn't accept them. And I think the way that can make you view yourself leaves you vulnerable to unhealthy coping mechanisms, for sure. But I also think that the way that we as gay men sometimes feel we should be maybe participating in the community can lead to like drug taking and sex and hooking up, and that's fine and it's great and people should absolutely enjoy themselves. But I think it's also opens the door perhaps for sort of pain avoidance and behaviors that can become addictive. And I think that that can happen to many people. And regardless of your childhood wounds or, you know, how you may have, your experience may not have been validated growing up. I think my parents, you know, I have a great relationship with my parents now. We struggled a bit. There was some religious context. But with Leo, he needs something to justify his behaviors. And he uses his parents as a way of making him feel better for what he's doing. And I think I just didn't want to make him this victim. He has a lot to answer for, and his parents have tried so hard with him, as many parents do with their kids who are struggling. And, you know, when I got sober, the most important piece of advice I ever got was no one's coming for you. No one's coming to save you. You've got to do this yourself. And for a long time, I thought I could explain my pain to people or tell them my trauma or elaborate certain situations in order to get people to empathize with me, but no one's going to come in and give you what you need. Only you can do that for yourself. And it was a really important part of my own journey. And Leo's not there yet. He's using his parents as an excuse to continue on, and then I wanted people to be surprised really when they meet his parents, and that his parents are sad about what's happening, and they want, you know, they've tried many times.
I found that really hard to read because it was really relatable to people in my life,
right.
And I think it is for so many people. Yeah, you think that it's you know, which it is for some, but for others it is just like a family who are, you know, trying their absolute best and are broken over their son or daughter dealing and struggling. Josh,
yeah.
Josh, for you, how did you? You said you realized no one was coming to help you, and that was where your journey started with becoming sober. What was that moment like for you? And was there like a rock bottom, and then you realized, fuck, I've got to change? Or was it? What was your sober journey like?
Yeah, it took a long time. It did not take. I did not have one light bulb moment. For me, it was many, many, many attempts of trying, and 12-step recovery was a big part of my journey to getting sober. I was going to meetings, but, you know, having 3 days, 4 days, a week, extending this gap and then thinking, no, I'm fine, because the consequences would wear off, and then the same shit just happening again and again and again, and just not being able to understand that I could do this stuff normally and, you know, the same consequences would happen time and time again. I lost, you know, my family sort of were done. My friends cut me out. I was sleeping on people's couches. I couldn't afford to get, you know, I'd rather spend my money on a packet of cigarettes and alcohol or drugs than get the bus to, you know, work or an audition or whatever I was doing back then. Although I somehow always managed to find it for the things that I thought I needed. But then I was always broke in terms of like the responsibilities of being an adult. And then I think I just had to lose so much and push myself into a corner of pain, sadly, that, you know, there is an old adage that there is the desperation is a gift. And I think that maybe that is true. And I think it is true. And I had to become very desperate and realize, I genuinely had to realize that no one is gonna pull me out of this. So I got my head down really and just did so many meetings, and I had to stop working in pubs and like change, cut people out of my life. It was a big upheaval. But yeah, I mean, I'm grateful it was a difficult time, but, you know, things are okay now.
That's so great to hear. You said in an interview I read, I think with another ABC journal, but you said that navigating sex and intimacy in the gay community is so complex, riddled with shame, pain, anxiety, and confusion, which people sometimes take copious amounts of drugs to deal with. And few writers are telling that less cozy version of our story. I think it's really interesting that, like, post-heated rivalry, right? Like we've seen at the start of this year, like mass hysteria, mass celebration, and like excitement around a show that's just like globally blown up. And a lot of the praise has been around, you know, showing gay and queer perspectives that end in, you know, like happiness and nothing goes wrong and there's no trauma. And that was really healing for people. But I think like, obviously now with Fruitfly and Fruitfly is doing so well, and that's also resonating with people as well. Why was it important for you to share this perspective of pain in the queer community as well?
I'm just interested in how we view other people's pain and what we will tolerate and through which lens we will take it. And I think as an author, having written books before in the publishing industry, not just Fruitfly is not my first book, I've written some young adult books before this. And I'm interested in publishing houses who say they want authentic voices and what that actually can look like or mean. Is it actually you want authentic voices, or you want what the people want to see, or how they, you know, a palatable version of that diverse group, or a version of that group that they can resonate with and get behind? Or do you want an authentic voice, you know? And people are scared to talk about chemsex. People are scared to talk about shame, pain. But, you know, we're in 2026. I suppose lots of gay people want to think, no, we're fine now. We don't need to keep saying that it's hard for us, but it is incredibly hard for the whole of the LGBTQ plus community. And it is not some people are like, oh, you can get married now, you're fine. And I think, you know, also in the wake of PrEP, which is a drug that men can take to prevent HIV transmission, that's fantastic. It's the most amazing thing that that's happened. But what it has also potentially done is open up a whole new world of liberation, which is fantastic. To not be scared of something that you should absolutely have in your life is wonderful. And, you know, it's huge, hugely important for the queer community. But that can go hand in hand with sort of pushing the boundaries of how much should or could or might be had, and what that looks like, and the drugs that can come into it. And I was at a writers' festival recently, and I was on a panel with a whole load of middle class, probably mostly straight people, because I asked them, does anyone know what PrEP is? And they, no one put their hand up. And I was like, this is wild to me that, like, you don't know what PrEP is. And, you know, but you all have seen Heated Rivalry, probably, or know what it is. And that's fine. Heated Rivalry is great and it serves its own purpose. But, like, if you want to get behind my experience, you should know. You should know. Like, this is the stuff we have to deal with, you know? And these are very real things. There's not a fantasy.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. I wonder if it's an age thing, but then also, like, PrEPs, we actually just did an episode all on PrEP like a month ago, and a full explain.
Oh, you did? Great.
Yeah. So if anyone listening who maybe has just seen your name in the title and they've never listened to The Hookup before, if you don't know what PrEP is, please go listen to that episode, because
to the PrEP episode.
Yeah, we talk about the history, we talk about, like, what it does and why it's important. But I love, Josh, that the massive theme of Fruit Fly is just who gets to tell whose stories, and the appropriation of pain, right? Which is kind of what you were talking about there, and who gets to profit off it. What do you want the reader to take away with that? Because it's obviously such a contentious and heated debate that we still are having over, like, who gets to tell whose story.
Yeah, I think I'll always say that I do believe that creativity should start from a place of freedom. We can't, well, you know, it's very nuanced, and, you know, this is not a black and white debate, but from what I've sort of learned over my time is, you can't limit people to only tell their experience. Otherwise, we'd only be writing autobiographies, and actors would only be playing themselves, which is ultimately not acting. But you have to bring in intention and why people are telling stories, why a creator would want to create the narrative they're telling. So it's twofold. I believe that we need more people from diverse backgrounds just in the mix in general. But then the intentions of telling the story need to be to either, you know, uphold, uplift that community, shine a light on a specific side of that community. But so much of it, because of the world we live in, is about profit and financial gain. And I think it's just hard for people to say out loud, you know, queer books in the YA space were selling big, and people were often asked to put queer characters in their books. And it's okay and great that people are representing the queer community, but is that the intention, or is the intention to sell it? And it's murky and difficult, but sometimes, like, even with Pride now, I'm like, you know, you go into a supermarket during Pride Month and you see the rainbow flag wrapped around a bar of soap, and I think, you don't give a shit. You did not give a shit 10 years ago, but now you are waving this Pride flag, but you're not. You're selling your soap. You don't give a shit. And, like, Uber or these big companies that, like, you will see that they're, like, celebrating Pride. No, it became marketable because the generation that came up didn't have a problem with it. And actually, to be accepting of it became cool almost. And I just think it became commercialized, and that's okay. But it's also not okay in some ways, because people just use appropriate to make money. And I wonder who the people at the top of these businesses are. And I wonder who the people at the top of these, you know, money-making machines are, who's pocketing the cash.
The rainbow washing, it's like the meme of getting an email every Pride Month just going, hi, gay. Like, and then crickets for the rest of the year. It's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, what are you doing outside of Pride Month, actually, for the LGBTQI plus community?
Yeah. Or what are you doing that's not performative on Instagram?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what are you doing actually in your circles? What, so much of this shit is performance and not real, you know? And people want to be seen as being inclusive because it's a branding thing. Even if you're not like selling yourself, it is a branding thing. You want people to see it. We all do it. That's what Instagram's for, is to brand ourselves. But I find it interesting that people will be very vocal online about stuff. But, you know, I always wonder what it looks like when no one's watching.
Exactly. And I have to say, when I read the book and didn't know anything about you, my first thought was like, oh, this kind of feels a little bit icky if the person behind writing this firstly wasn't gay, and also like I kind of wanted to know. I was like, oh, how much do they know about addiction? How much do they know about, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like it
did. And I'm happy to be questioned about that. I mean, I am writing a book about whether the subject matter needs to be authenticized by the creator, but I'm also writing from the point of view of a woman. I don't have the experience of a woman. And I think that was part of the meta aspect of it. You know, people have asked me, well, aren't you just doing what you're satirizing? And the answer is no, I'm part of the satire. I'm a creator. I'm aware that I'm part of the problem. I'm aware that I am part of this whole confusing debate about why we create stories and what we're trying to get from it. And if someone has a problem with me writing from a female perspective, then maybe they should have a problem with someone who's not in the gay community writing from the gay community's perspective. And then we can open that conversation up, and I'm really happy to do it. A lot of women helped me with writing Mallory. It was really informative, and I don't feel the need to sort of justify writing from her point of view, other than I did my best to make it as authentic as possible and used friends, editors, people in the publishing world to make sure that I wasn't stereotyping or being ignorant. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And I think that's very different to like Leo. Like Leo, you write from Leo's perspective, and that's a huge part of the book. And that is, like you said, drawn on from your experiences. But I just think it's such an incredible theme, and it's such an incredible idea for people to sit with and try and unpack. And I think that's why, not only because it's written so well, but I think that's also why it's done so well, is like it's so topical and these are the important conversations that we should be having. And
people don't want to have it, but it's good to be allowed to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's important to be having it. And I think that's why we're seeing such a huge in the past month, like the A24, congratulations, by the way, on A24 UK winning the rights, which means it's going to be a TV series.
Yeah, it does.
And I saw the viral clip of Jack Edwards gifting it to Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, which was wild.
Which is exciting. How are you feeling about post putting the book into the world and how crazily it's blown up and how well it's doing?
Yeah, I won't lie, it's been really strange. Like, I was a full-time nurse 10 weeks ago, crying in my car because I couldn't act the shifts and the writing at the same time, and I was like, I can't fucking do this anymore. And then I just was like, how am I supposed to continue? It was hard balancing both. And then things changed quite quickly, and I think I saw the power of the internet. And yeah, I think I used to roll my eyes a little bit about how BookTok works and how, but it's word of mouth at a million miles an hour, and I'm incredibly grateful to people like Jack and who enjoyed the book and then put it on his platform and got it in front of people. And yeah, and then, you know, the A24 thing was a sort of couple of months long process that's been ongoing for the last couple of months, and I felt very fortunate to meet with a number of studios who wanted to make it. And I just kind of felt like I'm going to seize this opportunity to try and give myself some time away from nursing and to write my next book. And I'm very fortunate that that's been able to happen for now. I mean, I'm also aware that this stuff is very transient and, you know, this stuff comes and goes, but this is you know, what I'd hoped for was just a bit of space to be able to not like feel super, super stressed after work and writing. And, you know, I was getting very burnt out. So I think I feel very grateful that that's been able to happen. I've slept quite a lot. And now I'm traveling, which is a dream. I've got my laptop in my bag right now and I'm writing my next book. And I've just received the first 20,000 words back from my agent who's enjoying it. And, you know, I couldn't ask for a more, you know, it's just very different, but great.
It's really exciting. It's really, really exciting. And then you think like, oh my God, when it's a TV show, that's a whole other, you know what I mean? That's a whole other.
If it's a TV show. I mean, yeah, but yeah, that would be so exciting.
Can you tell us anything about book two? Because obviously Fruit Flight ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. Is it different, related, nothing?
Yeah, it's different. Okay. It's different. I think what I will say is we will again follow two characters whose lives intertwine in a fairly catastrophic way. And you will see how they need to use and help each other in various amounts. And they're two totally different characters. And I'm really excited about it.
Yay. Okay. And you will put this all in the show notes, but you are coming to Australia. You have so many fans here, including Brendan.
Thank you. Yes.
What are the details of your trip to Australia?
Right. So I'm doing Brisbane Writers Festival. I can't remember the dates,
yeah,
but
we'll
they're on
in
my Instagram
notes.
Page.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm doing a date in Melbourne. I'm doing a date in Sydney at Gertrude and Alice. I think that's sold out though. And then I'm doing the Blue Mountains Writers Festival, which I'm really excited about. And then my little brother's getting married and I'm going to watch him get married.
So exciting. It's a huge, it's a huge moment. Please enjoy every second. You deserve it, Josh. It's so
awesome.
Thank
you so much. Can I say that it's a pleasure to speak with you. I really enjoyed it. You're a great interviewer.
Oh, thank you, Josh. No, thank you for writing such an awesome, you know, really, really thoughtful. Like, it's one of those books where you go away and you just... I ended up going to a book club. I loved it so much. I ended up going to... I paid to go to a book club so I could talk about it with other people for like 3 hours. You know, we unpacked it and it was just, everyone had so much to say and everyone loved it. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that.
It's so well deserved. And thank you so much for taking the time and for sitting in a park in New York and taking this call.
I'm really grateful. Thank you so much for having me.